Hello and welcome to another episode of the Serial and Planner podcast. I'm excited because in a couple weeks, I'll be back in my podcast studio. It'll finally be reconstructed after damage we sustained during this big storm in our area. So yay. Hopefully things will start getting a little bit more calm, a little bit easier going around here. So I thought it would be kind of fun to talk about the survey data. There's so much survey data. It's the gift that keeps on giving from this mega survey that we did a few weeks back of our readers and listeners at Student Loan Planner. And I thought we would talk about debt to income ratios and what the numbers really say. I thought this would be kind of a pretty fun thing to kind of go through some of the professions, kind of rank some of the highest debt to income ratio professions to some of the lowest, talk about some of the data that we see. And, you know, if you are asked ever by a young kid, starry-eyed, that wants to go into your field, you can give that kid, depending on their age, of course, the more accurate picture of what your profession economics look like and what the my future might be. And I think you'll just be interested to see and hear some of the data because, you know, we did get some emails from people. It's always funny when you do surveys because people always think about where they are in the distribution and not what the averages are. You know, we got some emails from people that were on the lower income side of things thinking like, oh my gosh, I need to go into the private sector. I mean, like there was a couple of people joking about it, but like that was one of their reactions. And then some of the other people's reactions on the other end of the income spectrum were like, you know, I mean, we got some interesting responses from some of the endodontist people out there that was like, ha ha, on that average, you should add, you know, a one in front of it because they're making like, you know, 1.3 million or something like that. And they just wanted to brag. I don't know. So it spans the gamut on the responses from the survey data whenever we put one out. But I thought this would be kind of a fun pod for today's podcast. So if I look at the overall data, the lowest debt to income ratio of anybody in our survey was actually engineers, which kind of makes sense. Engineers, I think, are often just very numbers-oriented, practical, how much debt, how much income, et cetera. Now, they were not anywhere close to the highest income in the survey, though. So that's another thing to think about, right? Is, you know, if you have more income to work with, you also have more options, more ways to move things around, right? So that's another thing to think about. But average income for engineers in our survey was about 150 grand, and their student debt was about 75. So they had a 0.5 debt-to-income ratio. They were the lowest. Now, the best debt-to-income ratio among people that require a professional degree was actually CRNAs. So CRNAs, right under 300K of average income. Goodness sakes. CRNAs out there, y'all are the stealth income crowd. That's a lot of income. 300K of average income almost with average student debt of about 213. So that was really surprising to me. I mean, I guess not really surprising because I know that a lot of the CRNAs have that kind of debt-to-income ratio, but that was pretty interesting for sure. Right after them, nurses, physicians, and physician assistants, those were the next crew, and then also nurse practitioners. So those folks are right in the 1-to-1 debt-to-income ratio sort of land, a little bit under 1-to-1 and right at 1-to-1. So for example, physicians making about 300K of average income and then about 300K of average student debt. Now, of course, the problem with physicians is there's a huge range. You've got pediatricians and you've got orthopedic surgeons and they're both physicians. So, you know, the problem with talking about averages like that is your higher income specialties are a lot more, I mean, they're better than CRNAs, right? Like if you're talking orthopedic surgery or neurosurgery or urology, your debt to income ratio is probably more like 0.5 like the engineers, but with like 3 or 4x the income. For the pediatricians, it's a little bit more like the veterinarians or the dentists out there in terms of debt to income ratio. So it is, you know, dependent on a variety of things within occupation about debt to income ratio, not just, you know, what the occupation is, but sometimes that stuff's a little bit hard to capture. Now, in the 1.25 to 1 debt to income ratio crowd, we saw lawyers, podiatrists, and pharmacists were the most popular group in that among that's requiring a professional degree at least. Lawyers about 160K of income, pharmacists about 150K of income, pretty similar, lawyers and pharmacists and average incomes in our email list at least. And also similar average student loan debt, about 200K for each of them. So if you are looking to have the lawyer lifestyle, you can also have it as a pharmacist. I'm joking around a little bit. I will say this, of course, the highest income lawyers significantly out-earned the highest income pharmacists. So, you know, and also, you know, our sample size, of course, is biased, right? Like our lawyers tend to be a little bit more likely to be like a mid-sized law firm or like an in-house counsel or even in a public sector kind of field. Whereas the people who follow my friend Josh Holt's Big Law Investor website tend to be mostly just, you know, big law associates, partners, et cetera. And those folks make a lot more than the people who tend to follow our email list for Student Loan Planner. In the next group of occupations, we've got dentists, dental specialists, optometrists. I'll save the next tier for the next couple minutes, but the dental specialist and the dentist and the optometrist, those folks are right around 1.5 to 1 debt to income ratio. So in other words, dental specialists, about 500K of student debt, about 360K of average income. And that's on average. If we look at optometrists, about 160K of income, then general dentists, about 238, and then 380K of student debt. So those numbers kind of all make sense. But the ratios for dentists, dental specialists, and optometrists are all pretty similar. The difference is just in the absolute amount of income those occupations have. So optometrists, 160, dentists, about 238, let's just say 240, dental specialists, 360. If I was looking at that kind of setup, you know, one of the things that I would sort of ask myself, if you're trying to figure out what field to get into, what specialty or whatever, I would say, what kind of life do you want to lead? Right? You can make an absolute wonderful living as a general dentist in an out-of-the-way area and make a killing. Now, if you want to live in an urban area that's a little bit more competitive to live in, then I think a lot of times what happens is it's an easier life to be a dental specialist because you have less competition, you have more specialization, you have, you know, a higher predictable number of procedures that you've been trained in. So this is like very qualitative, but I have done consults for probably at least 1,000 dentists and dental specialists over 10 years. And just like a qualitative take is the urban area general dentists are super stressed out. The urban area dental specialists are significantly less stressed out. And then the out-of-the-way general dentists in rural areas or exurban areas or even, you know, lower competition suburban areas, they're not very stressed out. Those are just some of the qualitative things. So I guess, for example, if I wanted to live in downtown Kansas City or something like that, it's probably better to be a dental specialist than a dentist. If I wanted to live in like rural Minnesota, it's probably better to be a general dentist than a dental specialist because it's a little bit easier to get all the procedures you need to keep you busy if you're a little bit of more of a jack of all trades, so to speak. But anywho, that's the tier three in terms of debt to income ratios. Tier four, I'm going to say, is the physical therapist, psychologist, therapist, veterinarians, and occupational therapists. So those are folks in the 1.5 to 2 debt to income ratio. Most folks are making a decent income at this level. So physical therapists right at 100K average income, psychologists 134. Veterinarians 150. I mean, those incomes are all pretty decent. And then average student loan debt, that's kind of proportional to those incomes. So 230 for psychologists, 160 for physical therapists, 270 for veterinarians. So if I think about those incomes, you know, the veterinarian income about 150 is similar to lawyers and pharmacists, which is kind of interesting if you think about it. Psychologists not too much farther behind at 134. The variance in these incomes is a little bit lower than those at some of the other fields like dentistry and physicians, but the incomes are still pretty decent. And, you know, the student loan debt ranges all over the place, right? Like, you know, some of the veterinarians and psychologists can have over 400K of student loan debt because some of the schools that offer those spots are pretty expensive. So that's sort of tier four. And then tier five is the highest debt to income ratios. Tier five occupations are chiropractors, acupuncturists, and naturopathic doctors. Those folks are dealing with debt to income ratios of above two. There's a big difference between chiropractors and acupuncturists and naturopaths. It's a 2.2 to 1 debt to income ratio for chiropractors, and then 3.05 for acupuncturists, and then 3.3 for the NDs. So, you know, these fields are where I see some of the most abusive behavior by schools. Some of the biggest lies told by schools. I mean, I remember going to one chiropractic conference once when I was in St. Louis, and somebody told me a story about a school flying people to the school over the weekend and paying for it to try to convince them to sign up for chiropractic school. And when they said yes, they were making 200K in grad plus revenue, right? So it was basically like a it was sort of almost like borderline illegal what the school was doing, but they were getting people to sign up that way. And it was just very aggressive recruiting tactics. And I've seen a lot of very aggressive advertisements from chiropractic schools showing, you know, ripped people working out, talking about how you're going to become a doctor, you're going to help people get better after injuries. But at the same time, it's a lot of hype. The way that they pitch themselves is sort of like they're trying to sell you versus you, I don't know, versus one of some of the schools that are just like, we have a, you know, law school, apply if you want. I mean, I'm just joking. There's still law schools out there that, you know, are super aggressive in their recruitment practices too. But, you know, the Cairo schools are another level. And then another level above that is the acupuncture and ND programs, the naturopath programs. Those programs, by and large, just tell what I've seen over time, just absolute falsehoods. You know, promising people you're going to make a gazillion dollars. The income difference is not that different from physicians. You're going to be able to practice, you know, this alternative style of medicine that's going to lead to huge career satisfaction. And I think a lot of our folks that are NDs or acupuncturists do have career satisfaction. But the reality is average incomes for acupuncturists on our list, 60K. For NDs, naturopaths, it's 90,000. So 90,000 is a big difference from the physician average, which is 300,000. But the ND student debt is 300, and so is med school debt of 300. Unless somebody is okay making 90 instead of 300, you're borrowing the same amount, you're spending a similar amount of time in the program. My one prediction, at least from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, is I think most acupuncturist and naturopathic medicine programs are probably going to close based off of the, that's a little bit of a hot take, but that's one observation based on some of the survey data. And a lot of chiropractic schools, I think, will probably close as well. The only thing that might save some of the chiro schools is they will be treated as professional degree programs and they'll be able to borrow 50K per year. That's 200K total. That probably is still enough for a lot of the chiro schools to not close, but there still will be some closures because they're not going to be able to tap Grad Plus anymore. So again, the tiers among the professions for debt to income ratio, you've got engineers, CRNAs, and nurses in one tier, tier one. Then you've got physician, physician assistant, nurse practitioner in tier two. I'll throw in speech language pathologist in this tier three, but speech language pathologist, lawyer, podiatrist, and pharmacist in tier three. Physical therapists, psychologists, and veterinarians in tier four. And then occupational therapists or, you know, chiropractors, acupuncturists, and naturopathic doctors in tier five. And that's in terms of best debt to income ratios to the toughest debt to income ratios. Now, if we look at where professions are some of the best wealth generators relative to their incomes, so this is kind of an interesting thing to look at because it's sort of like, what is the ratio of how much wealth somebody has generated relative to their income? So I'll read you off some of the top ones. Nonprofit employees are actually number one. Those folks had 3.4 times their income in total wealth. That was the highest of any occupation in the survey that we did. Teachers were number two at 2 times their income and wealth, and then followed by engineers. And then, you know, we got down the list. So physical therapists, podiatrists were pretty high up there. Naturopathic doctors are actually kind of higher up there. Nurse practitioners at 1.6 times their income and wealth. Pharmacists are right behind them. So that was kind of like the more frugal professions. And then the less frugal ones, lawyers 1.4, psychologists 1.4, nurses 1.4, dental specialists 1.4, physicians 1.3, chiropractors 1.2, physician assistants 1.2. And then the least good at generating wealth relative to their income professions, dentists, optometrists, veterinarians, and CRNAs. So those were, that was just kind of interesting, like the professions that seem to be, for lack of a better word, the spendiest. So, I mean, it's all relative, right? I mean, everybody in the survey was, most professions were between 1 and 2 times their income and wealth growth. So it's not a massive, massive difference. I did see another kind of interesting stat in the survey about, you know, average housing payment among different professions. It was fairly correlated to income. But interestingly enough, it wasn't exactly correlated like one-to-one to income. So for example, urologists might have had a twice as high of an income as a lawyer, like, but maybe the urologist is making three times the lawyer and the housing payment's only two times. That sort of makes sense to me in terms of why some of these higher income professions end up growing more wealth over time, because it's like there wasn't a huge, huge difference in the average car payment. Like, there were differences. Like, you know, the average physician was paying something like $800 a month for a car payment, I think. Actually, so $760 a month was the average car payment among physicians. But then average car payment among pharmacists was $790. So what's interesting there is, and it kind of makes sense, like once you drive a nice car, most people are not upgrading to Porsches and Ferraris and Lambos. Like, most people are stopping at a brand new SUV or, you know, a brand new minivan, right? Like, and then they just drive that. And so I thought that was kind of interesting. That's one argument for having a higher income, is it does give you a lot more flexibility and less pressure on your finances around these big fixed payments. Another thing I noticed about the average housing payment in the survey, a lot of our readers or listeners are in their 30s and 40s. That kind of makes sense because the average housing payment was like it was $2,400 a month. That was the average housing payment. That's really low. That's indicative that most people in the survey have locked in a 3% mortgage rate and have not purchased a house in the past couple of years. Average house payment, if you buy now with the current interest rates, is like $5,000-$6,000 for just a reasonable house. That's like a $700,000 really nice house that's like a $5,000 or $6,000 a month payment. So that was another interesting thing that I'd noticed, was as long as our professionals and our audience are disciplined on not doing dumb home renovations, like, you know, I've done a couple of those, and not blowing it in terms of any other big ticket items that are recurring fixed expenses in your finances, as long as you avoid that, people in our audience that are working even towards payoff or loan forgiveness, it doesn't even matter. Your finances are going to work out great. Like, folks that have locked in low fixed housing payments for the long term, you're really in great shape on the having enough money to invest side of things. Now you just got to go out and do good with the investing. Those are some of the big points that I had, big thoughts that I had from looking at our survey. I do think that when we talk about the fall, what's going to happen with student loans, I think we're going to see a lot of conversation around legal actions being taken by consumer groups against Department of Ed, trying to force Department of Ed to process forgiveness, process IBR, process PSLF. And we're going to continue to see court hearings into the fall, through the end of the fall with this. And then we're also going to see negotiated rulemaking continue to move forward to try to rewrite the rules surrounding PSLF, probably in a more restrictive way. So that's something that we need to be monitoring for folks. We also need to be monitoring, you know, the Eighth Circuit decision that somehow is still waiting out in the ether about whether or not pay and ICR and save, you know, are illegal in addition to being, you know, not allowed anymore long term with the congressional bill that they wrote with the Big Beautiful Bill Act. That does phase them out gradually. And there's a broader question of, like, are they unconstitutional in general, which the Eighth Circuit still is taking its sweet time on. So we'll cover it all for you, so you don't have to worry about it. Thank you for listening to our SLP podcast. If you have any questions for the pod, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. And if you want to share any thoughts about it, just reply to one of my email newsletter updates that come out every Thursday. And if you're not on that email newsletter, you can join it at studentloanplanner.com. Thank you all for listening. Have a wonderful rest of your week. Are you on the free Student Loan Planner email list? If yes, you can upgrade your experience and discover student loan loopholes so good, they might get repealed if I talk about them publicly. Find out my very best thought leadership that I really just can't be super open about anymore, unfortunately. If you want to get our very best tips, not just the ones that I can share for free, go to studentloanplanner.com/insider to get a special discount for your year membership. That's studentloanplanner.com/insider and get our very best dozens of bonus content and tips that's going to save you money and get you out of student debt faster. And if you're already an SLP insider, please reply back to those emails and let me know how I can make it even more valuable.